Some guys have seen things that no one ever wants to see. I understand now what it means. When you go to a veteran ceremony and you see the old veterans get together and hug and cry, and you never really understood it before. I understand it now.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. The war in Iraq has been analyzed, debated, and protested. Now Martha Raddatz hones in on the perspective of U.S. soldiers in her book, The Long Road Home. Raddatz is ABC's chief White House correspondent. She has also worked for National Public Radio. Raddatz takes readers inside a beleaguered American platoon fighting a gruesome battle in 2004. Most of the young U.S. soldiers were in combat for the very first time. Among those who fell was a young mechanic, Casey Sheehan. His mother, Cindy, became one of the war's best-known opponents. This discussion of The Long Road Home took place in May of 2007 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Thank you very much. I'm usually in the audience, so it's it's kind of turning the tables here. This book, I wrote while I was covering the White House, actually. So it was interesting to me because I literally would be at the White House all day, do my regular job at ABC and leave and go back to my office at ABC and write till 1 or 2 in the morning. I did not take a leave of absence. And someone the other day asked me if I was going to write another book, and I said it's like asking a woman who just had a baby if they want to have another one. So I've had 2 children, though, so, you know, you forget it after a while how bad it was. But was mentioned, I've been to Iraq more than a dozen times. And when I started covering the war, I was the Pentagon correspondent for ABC, and I have essentially been covering the Pentagon for 13 or 14 years. And frankly, I still do that, and I still think it's important to cover Iraq, and largely because I've been covering it for so long that I feel that I can really go there and take the temperature. I was very hesitant when I first started going, and people would ask me how it's going, to say, well, it's good, it's bad, it's this or that, it's black or white, because it never has been, and I don't think it ever will be. But I do, from my travels back and forth, feel in a pretty good position to know where we were the 2 months prior to where I've been, or the 6 months prior to where I've been. When you travel there, when I travel there over the years, you're often brought into the briefings, and the briefings are really the facts, and given by soldiers and Marines to their superior officers about what's happening on the ground. So to me, that is really valuable to see over and over again as I go back to see. I mean, what's really frustrating for the military especially, and I know that they get mad at the media and everyone else and say you're not saying any of the good news, is they do make progress. They do. But it's kind of like progress down a crumbling hill of sand sometimes. So it's very frustrating for them because they do the best they can, I guess, and it doesn't always mean that it sends them a step forward. This particular story, in 2004, it's April 4th, 2004, and the thing that was remarkable about it was the soldiers who arrived there from the 1st Cavalry Division arrived in Sadr City. It's hard to remember when Sadr City was actually peaceful, but in the previous year, only one soldier had died in that area. So the 1st Cavalry Division came in, and the very moment they turned over this area of Sadr City to this battalion, and a battalion is about 700 soldiers. The very day, minute they turned it over, they had a platoon out in the city doing a sewage run, and that platoon was pinned down, and the gunner in the Humvee, there were 4 Humvees in this little convoy, and the gunner was killed, and they were pinned down by first hundreds and then thousands of Mahdi militia members. And they took refuge in an alley. I'm sure this is where the comparisons with Black Hawk Down were, but they took refuge in an alley in a house. They had to put the Iraqis in the house, in the back of the house. They set up a position on the roof. But then by that time, there were thousands and thousands of Mahdi militia out on the streets. And so when the rescue units came in to try to find this platoon, and because they had just handed over the command, a lot of the radios weren't working. The GPS systems weren't hooked up yet in the Humvees, so they could not find this platoon. And within a few hours, they had 8 soldiers dead, and they had more than 60 wounded. And when I first heard about this battle, and it really was, from the very beginning of covering this war, you did a different story every day. I mean, it moves so rapidly from one horrific event to the next, or, you know, from Abu Ghraib to whatever's happening the next day. And when I heard this and I went to Sadr City, I was in Baghdad when I heard about it, and I went to Sadr City the next day or two, and we did a nightline. And it really was so incredible to me to meet these soldiers and to have even the few minutes I got with each one of them. And there were, it was kind of like this, but a lot darker, and we were in a little tactical operations center, and they had lined up these 6 or 7 soldiers who'd been in this battle. And I really took them one at a time, but the minute the first one sat down and started telling his story, it was so powerful and so emotional. It was that part of the war I felt like we hadn't really heard. And the nightline I did, I thought was really unbelievably powerful. And it was really just their voices explaining what happened that night. There's a guy named Robert Miltenberger, a sergeant, who'd been kind of the typical guy in the army, you know, had been there maybe 20 years, looked about 25 though, had tried to retire before they went to Iraq. And the thing that you probably all heard Secretary Rumsfeld talk about, that little stop loss at the bottom, they wouldn't let him retire because of the stop loss, which basically says if your unit is deploying in a time of war, you have to go with them. So Sergeant Miltenberger went with him and never done anything remarkable in his career in the army, but that day led one of the rescue squads. He was in the back of an open truck, and they sent in to rescue these guys because they thought this was going to be a peacekeeping mission in giant open trucks. I mean, they're cargo trucks. They are not meant for combat. They're meant for nothing except moving soldiers around in peaceful areas and cargo. And Sergeant Miltenberger was in the back of one of these trucks. And there is a picture in this book, which I wish was 10 times bigger, because you can actually see his helmet. And within minutes, as they enter this street, the back of his truck was just under withering fire. And he saved so many lives that day. I mean, he started describing it to me, and he started weeping. And soldiers don't really like to weep. And it was so moving. And I know a lot of people said to me, how did you get these guys to talk in such incredibly intimate detail? And I think it's because people really hadn't asked them about it before. I think, you know, you look back at veterans in this country, or veterans of World War II or any conflict, and they all talk about not really talking about this. And I think part of that is no one asks them. Or we say, what was it like? You know, did you see any bad things? Did someone get killed? And they don't really say, and then what happened? And how did you do that? And how did you find the courage? And how did you keep going on? And when Miltenberger talked to me about this, and it was, he'd never talked to anybody about it. These guys really hadn't talked to anybody about it. And it is not a culture, as you probably imagine, that's very touchy-feely, particularly when you're over there, nor, you know, should it be if they're going right out the next day. But when you get people talking about this and really understand, and that's what I wanted to do more than anything, understand what that was like for them. I, having gone over there so many times myself, I am interested in how people respond to terror and to fear. And one of the things I found about a lot of these men and women is that sometimes they're more afraid of how they'll act when they are afraid than actually being afraid. I find that myself sometimes, that you want to be calm or you want to do the right thing and you want to do the right thing for others who are with you. But it is a strong motivating factor. But someone like Miltenberger, who had not ever been in battle before, none of these guys in this battle had been in battle before. I mean, they'd never fired a gun in battle. They'd never... Colonel Robert Abrams, who is the son of Creighton Abrams, the legendary Vietnam general, was in this battle. He was the brigade commander brigade is about 3,000 soldiers. So he was over all these 700. And his descriptions of walking through there and seeing the wounded were just so intimate. And Colonel Abrams, I went back. I kept going back. I went into the alley with them the first time they'd been back to the alley, and it was, I've never been to that alley when it wasn't dangerous. And in fact, the last time I was in Iraq, at the end of March, we couldn't go because it was so bad. Plus the American presence sort of inflames everything. But that first time we went in there, I think I was out of the Humvee for about 2 minutes, and then we had to jump back in. But I wanted to do a follow-up at the end of the 1st Cavalry's year deployment there. By the end of that year, again, they thought this was a peacekeeping mission. They had lost 168 soldiers. And visit with them. The division has 20,000, but 168, and mostly in this community of Fort Hood, Texas. And Colonel Abrams started, and other soldiers, I said, I just want to talk about your year and how hard this was. And Colonel Abrams, who I can't describe enough, is this just sort of Mr. Salute. And if you were raised by Creighton Abrams and your two older brothers were generals and, you know, your whole family was permeated with military, it's not exactly, you know, a fun, raucous guy to be around. But he is, actually, if you get to know him. But he, I ask him, and I'm not, you know, how does it feel sort of questions, but I just said, you know, what's your year been like? And he started, you know, well, ma'am, we did this, that, the other, blah, 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 blah. And he said, it's our families that, and he could not go on. He was crying so hard, which was, I mean, it was incredibly uncomfortable in that room because you could tell he was unbelievably embarrassed about doing that, just unbelievably embarrassed. And it was such a beautiful interview, though, because he kept trying to pull himself back together. You know, he'd say, it's our families, and he'd start crying, and he'd say, I knew I would do this. Like, my wife told me not to do this, but I can't help it. And his reaction to the families, and then others said, you have to interview the families. Colonel Abrams, actually, that day, and, you know, remember, we're in Sadr City, and this time we are in the middle of, you know, there's no notion of peacekeeping at this point. He leaves and he calls me on the cell phone. He says, you're not going to run that, are you? I'm just so embarrassed. And I said, don't worry, you know, you're in good hands. This is truly so powerful. And he was so embarrassed that he wrote an email to his division commander, General Pete Corelli, that said, sir, I was interviewed by ABC today and I try to do the division proud, but today I broke down in an interview with Martha Raddatz, and I have let the division down by crying. General Corelli, and he's just, it's so great, writes back, and obviously he shared it with me later. He wrote back, you would have let us down if you'd done anything else. So I think it was such a strong bond that they had developed. So when I started interviewing the families and asking them about that night, about that really a 24-hour period before they finally got this platoon out and what that was like. I mean, the stories of the wives and families and mothers and where they happened to be and the diversity of the group. We go from Colonel Abrams, who was in the battle, to Cindy Sheehan's son. This was the night Cindy Sheehan's son happened to be killed, no one knew who she was at the time when I started reporting this. And this book is totally non-political. And I certainly interviewed the Sheehans, and they told me about that night, but I interviewed the families of all eight who died, and certainly many of the wounded as well, and what it was like for them, and how we, if we don't have anyone in the military or civilians who are serving over there in some capacity, have absolutely no idea what it's like for them, just no idea. And no matter how people feel about the war, I really wanted them to feel what war is like for the families, for those fighting, and to see what it was like day by day. I think you will come away from this book with some things you think went wrong in this battle and some preparedness issues, but I think you also just get a sense of human beings who are essentially sent there and try every day to get through it. The 1st Cavalry Division is now back. the battalion commander, who actually, I'm going to read a little small. Gary Valesky was the battalion commander over these 700 men, and he's one of the first people I met. He is now back in Iraq, but this is his losing eight guys the first night. He said, "Some guys have seen things that no one ever wants to see. I understand now what it means. When you go to a veteran ceremony and you see the old veterans get together and hug and cry, and you never really understood it before, I understand it now." Gary is now a colonel in Baghdad. I see him whenever I go back, and I'm quite close to his family, who I just saw recently in Fort Hood. He has a young son and a wife who really brought together the battalion that night and was in charge of making sure the families were taken care of, going to see the families, making sure. I mean, it's this terrible thing because they try to be so humane in the military about how you notify a family member, but it can break down, and that night it broke down. They couldn't find the family of one of the soldiers. He's from Guam, and his family had moved, and they could not find him. And there's a rule that until you notify all the families in a particular battle who've been killed, you can't tell the rest of the battalion back home, or the battalion families, who's been killed. So it was getting horrible. So Leanne Valesky and her friend Connie Abrams, who were kind of running this family readiness group, just took it upon themselves and sat down and said, you know what, these rules are to be humane, and we are not being humane. The people in the family in Guam will not hear about this. We're not identifying him, but we have to identify the others so they're not worried about their own family members. So that is what I tried to do. I hope I achieved that. I continue to stay in touch with all of these people. There's an appendix at the end where everybody is now, and a lot of them are back there, or a lot of them are in Afghanistan. But it is really the story of this war, and I think this battle was the day, was a turning point in this war, was when it really did become, or we realized it had become, an insurgency. It was the day the military thought, you know what, maybe they don't like us. And I think they realized it was a different war they'd be in. They needed different equipment. One of the reasons they had these open trucks is because and they didn't bring in all their tanks for this particular battle, or not this battle, but this deployment, because they thought it was a peacekeeping mission. And if you go in, and it was a Shiite area, Sadr City is a Shiite area, so they assumed that going into these areas that the Shiites would like the Americans because they were the ones under the thumb of Saddam Hussein for so many years. So they didn't bring all their tanks, because if you bring a tank into a city and you're trying to be a peacekeeper, it sends the wrong message. Plus, you can kill a lot of people if you have to shoot a gun, and they didn't want to kill innocent people. So it is not ever quite as simple as it's almost like any question you ask about one thing leads you to an answer that, I mean, that's why they didn't bring the tanks. Obviously, they wish they had tanks that night. They had some. In fact, they're eventually the people who got the platoon out, but they didn't have as many as they wanted. But even if they'd had them there, that convoy wouldn't have been in tanks that night. They would have been in Humvees. So I'm happy to answer questions, and thank you very much for having me here. Okay, go ahead.
Yes, thank you for writing this book about the families that are actually carrying the burden of this war. One question that I had is, how did what you saw and what you reported then in this book inform how you report now?
I think what I've seen and what I continue to see and why I want to continue to see it informs me in ways that I never, ever could have been the reporter I am today. It is hard for me sometimes to go to Iraq and come back to the White House. I joke with people that I'm the only person, I think, who's been in Ramadi in the Lincoln bedroom in 1 week. And unfortunately, I only spent the night in one of those places, and it wasn't the Lincoln bedroom. But I know when I ask the president questions or when I write stories about Iraq that I do not look at this purely as policy. I know what's happening on the ground. I know the language of war. I know what commanders' jobs are and what commanders-in-chief's jobs are. I know what strategy is. I know what tactics are. I can have a dialogue, I feel like, at the White House with people that perhaps some of my other White House correspondents don't. So I hope I bring that to my job. People all say, well, oh, you know, are you still objective about the war? I mean, I am not objective about human beings dying. And I feel very strongly about what is happening there and what will continue to happen there. It's not me. It's not up to me to make policy decisions or to judge what's happening. But I certainly feel strongly about it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
First of all, thank you for this book. I read it. You accomplished everything you set out to do.
Thank you.
Just couldn't put it down. My heart was racing as I was reading it.
Thank you.
My question to you is this. Do you think that the situation we're facing today in Iraq is really a result of the fact that we didn't have those 300,000 troops to come in and sort of peacekeeping after the initial war period was over? And if that had happened, we would today have a relatively stable, unified, possibly democratic-type government in Iraq? Or was there a more profound misconception that these various three groups, the Shia, the Sunni, the Kurds, have hated each other for reasons we can't even begin to understand for 1,000 years, and that the minute the lid is off the pot, everything's going to blow?
I think probably somewhere in between. I think, I think that's a question that would be debated forever. It's interesting to me because lately I've heard more and more people talk about what you're talking about, number two. I don't ever like this idea that, you know, they all hate each other, so they're going to fight each other anyway. And I covered the war in Bosnia as well. And, you know, it's like, oh, we can't do anything about that because they all hate each other. I mean, I guess the premise of that, I don't like that. I like to think that people can get through things like that. The 300,000 troops, I also think will be debated forever, but on its face, I mean, we didn't guard the infrastructure, we didn't guard the ammo dumps. I mean, people always say to me, geez, where do they get all those weapons? Are they smuggling them in? Like, the whole place is a giant ammo dump. It's like, you know, we said, let's have a war, we'll supply the weapons. So it's partly that, but I think when you have chaos in the way we had it, and the infrastructure isn't protected, people don't feel safe because there's such chaos and anarchy in the streets. I think that's when they first start thinking, ugh, what side should I be on? These guys didn't protect me, so maybe I shouldn't feel protected by them. And maybe it's the old fence-sitter thing. And I think you would have had fewer fence-sitters if you had a larger number of troops, probably.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I applaud all your work through the years.
Thank you.
So many questions to ask, but I'll focus on two quick ones.
Okay.
What do you think? You mentioned the mood of the troops. I would assume that most of them still feel that they're doing good work in Iraq. So that's my first question.
Let me answer that one quickly.
Sure.
I think they have to.
Yeah.
I think you can't go over there and risk your life every day and not think you're trying to accomplish something. One thing I worry about, and I don't think there'll ever be a Vietnam where we don't welcome the troops or where we look upon the military as horrible, awful human beings. But I still think that there is such a separation between civilians who aren't there, and because it's a volunteer army, because there's no real connection between us and the troops, I think the troops start feeling really tribalized and like it's us against, not against us, but it's us for. It's us, the troops, we the troops, and we're doing it for them, and they don't understand what we're doing. So I do think there's a disconnect. I feel like the morale is pretty good, but again, I think it just has to be. You can't go over there. It's interesting because the vast majority of deaths are from IEDs, from the improvised explosive devices. And I've talked to so many soldiers and Marines, and I think this will be something we see in the future about how helpless they feel. It's not like going in there and this is what we trained for and we can defend ourselves and we can fight the bad guys. They're just driving around getting blown up. And it does something horrible to you. First of all, you can have that happen any second. I think Vietnam, that the amount of time they spent in the battles came maybe every 40, 50 days. So there was a time in between when they felt relatively safe. These guys never feel safe. And I think it's a horrible thing for everything about their post-traumatic stress disorder.
Sure, yes.
Okay, question?
Martha, I was in Iraq, and I think you've done an excellent job, and I appreciate you writing this book.
Thanks.
I think you've done a good job of illustrating what military people and their families go through, and thank you for that. But I'm curious whether in the beginning you had any difficulties getting it published. In other words, did you have any literary agents or publishers telling you that people are burned out on reading about the war and
yes.
don't want another book?
I actually, I got it published quite quickly, and I had the advantage of having those nightlines, so they could see that this book was different and told a different story than most of the Iraq books out there. And most of the Iraq books have been policy books, or they've been written by soldiers and Marines who were there. And I think this one was different. I am not in this book at all. It is not about me. It is about you. And so I didn't get it. I didn't have a difficult time publishing it, but they are very wary of books about Iraq because, frankly, I don't think they've sold very well. I mean, I'm doing pretty well, and they're very happy about that, but I think it's unusual other than the, you know, big blockbuster fiasco and books like that. But I think it's going to be rough from here on out to get books on Iraq published for a while.
Thank you again for writing the book.
Thanks.
Because you've spent so much time interviewing the families of this platoon, do you have any comments or information about the way the injured family members have been treated once they've got back to, say, Fort Hood or
yeah, here? I could talk about this one forever, but the thing, I mean, their initial care is fantastic. I mean, those combat support hospitals in theater are just unbelievable. I know Bob Woodruff, my colleague, was here, and many of you may have seen him. I was just in the combat support hospital in Balad where Bob and Doug's lives were saved. And it was actually very moving because I called Bob from there because there were a lot of the doctors and nurses and the medics and stuff were talking about him. And I said, you know, Bob's on a book tour too. Let me call him and talk to him. So we passed the phone around in the combat support hospital. It was very moving. It was moving for Bob, and it was moving for the staff there as well. Once they get here, Bethesda Naval Hospital is phenomenal. The immediate care there and the immediate care at Walter Reed. I think the country is completely ill-prepared for what happens now, what happens afterwards. We've got so many wounded. We are not prepared for it, for the traumatic brain injuries. I, as not a reporter, but as a human being, go to Bethesda fairly regularly, and I've heard stories there that are just awful. And there was one young family, what happens, for instance, is a Marine reservist who was injured there and had brain damage and was in a coma. And his wife was a teacher in Minnesota, and they had two little kids. I mean, this guy was in the hospital for so long, she had to quit her job. So the kids are back in Minnesota, so she never sees the kids. They don't really have a way to fly all the kids out there. The military certainly doesn't pay for that, the government. So they rely on private funds. There's one I love called the Semper Fi Fund that really literally just hands money to the wounded and their families so they can pay their rent for a couple of months or whatever they have. There was another, a young couple, and he had slight brain injury, but he was blind and literally had no eyes. And when he finally was released from Bethesda, they went back to the VA in Florida. And the staff there is, first of all, so used to just working with older vets. So he was put in with Alzheimer's patients, even though, you know, he wants to have an active life. And the very first day he arrived, they just sat him down for his tests when he came in, and they took him through, and they did his blood pressure and heart, and they sat him down in front of an eye chart and asked him to read the eye chart. And he, with a great sense of humor, said, I am BLIND. So, yeah. But I mean, I remember when I first saw these guys, and they have such magnificent attitudes when they're up there. I mean, they're just so great, and they're in touch with their units, and everybody supports them. What I worry about is how they feel in 5 years. and what kind of care they get there. And I think the country really has to reboot itself on where we go from here.
One of the problems with the VA is it's overwhelmed with people who have come from other wars or people who fall below the poverty line. And the VA can't just summarily dismiss somebody who's been in the VA system forever.
Right.
And then that creates a problem of personnel and a bureaucracy and some very foolish people who work as staff. But my part is really something you've alluded to, and that is human beings are human beings. And one of the huge problems that occurs with the debate in the Congress is get out and let them kill themselves. And my mentality just can't accept that. And the really big deal is the Bosnian conflict didn't have to deal with suicide bombers. You've really been a very gentle person in the various discussions you've been in. But nobody has really discussed how to deal with the problem of the suicide bombers or how to keep strategies from being published in the international media. And I wondered if you'd say some things about that. How do you pollute the soul so it doesn't go to paradise?
I don't know. And I think that's one of the things. I, for years, have been using the language after talking to some very smart people years ago about what to call the global war on terrorism, or why do we call it that? And if you call something a war, does that mean you can just go in and kill everybody and think it can end? It clearly doesn't. I mean, people are regenerating as faster than we're killing them. And I started referring to it years ago as a global insurgency, with the idea that the approach to insurgency in Iraq, for instance, and it is very different than the approach to a conventional war. And it involves winning hearts and minds. It involves jobs and reconstruction and giving people something so they will come over to the brighter side. And the global insurgency, I think we haven't done enough of that. I don't think we understand that you have to add that dimension to how we approach the global war on terrorism. And I noticed that the State Department, for the first time in its look at terrorism in the last year, called it that we are facing a global insurgency. And I think we have to develop a global counterinsurgency, which we haven't really done yet. We haven't reached out and convinced people that they shouldn't blow themselves up. I have zero answers on how that could be done, but certainly we've got to start.
I want to thank you, first of all, because it really, it's good to have someone that tells us what it's like over there. Otherwise, the rest of us don't have any way to know. So you're very brave, so I appreciate
thank
that.
Thank you.
I wanted to say, I have a question, and then my dad, after World War II, I think one reason he never talked about it was he said he thought nobody would believe him.
I think you find that, too. And it's also, I had a terrific discussion in New York a couple weeks ago with some young soldiers and Marines who were saying the same thing. They come back, and first of all, they don't know that anybody, but also that they didn't want to burden their families with it. And I said, guess what, guys? You're burdening your families more by not telling them, because then you feel even more apart from what they've gone through. But
yeah,
it didn't work, my maternal stuff, I'm sure. I tried. Never works with me either at home. So
I think it bothered him that it was like the guys were numbers. You know, the whole thing about humanizing, it's very hard to humanize it, but it needs to be done because that's really...
That's very much what I try to do and want to do. I agree.
And my question really is, during Vietnam, of course, there was a draft, and that's when I was going through high school and college, and it was so different. And I guess the official people don't want to even think, except Charlie Rangel, don't really want to think about the draft again, because I guess they feel that you get more loyal soldiers if you have volunteers. But it seems like the volunteer group comes from a certain, maybe a couple different pools. And I guess I just feel that there is this real disconnect with the war, like we're not really paying for it, we're not. And the draft, I guess I've always supported the idea of some kind of national service for women and men. And the soldiers, they don't like the idea of a draft, or
I think they think of it as a professional military now, and that's why they don't like the idea of a draft, because those who are there want to be there and want to be soldiers and Marines and airmen and in the Navy. So it's, I think there's that. I people ask me whether we think there'll be another draft, and I said, I just want you to try to imagine who would be getting up and saying, we're going to start the draft now. So if you think there's going to be one, just try to imagine who, you know, Who would be making that announcement? Unless, you know, there's some terrible, terrible threat to the homeland. I think not. But National Service, I think, I've talked to a lot of people about that, too, because I, you know, we are disconnected. And I don't think everyone is cut out to join the military. But serving the nation, I think, is an honorable thing to do. And if there's some way to do that, whether it's Teach for America or whatever you do, it is a wonderful thing to serve our country. And I think it's something we've gotten away from in a very bad way.
Thank you.
Yeah, you talked at the beginning that you were interested in people's response. And I wondered if you could say some more about your own response. I mean, in terms of how you deal with the fear, because, you know,
denial is just fabulous. It works for me.
Is that what it is?
I think some days we get up and we feel really brave and strong about ourselves, no matter what we do. And that, you know, we're going to go to work and we're going to face the boss, or we're going to go home and we're going to explain this to our children, or whatever it is, you're just really strong that day. And other days, you're not. I've been there so often that truly, I when I first started flying in there, and it's unbelievably terrifying, it can be, because you're doing spirals and your view is basically the ground the entire time, and you know they're talking about missiles, and every briefing they give you, particularly if you're with the Marines just try to scare the hell out of you. I mean, it's just, and my joke with Marines is, like, the only time you guys are happy is when you're miserable, and you're even happier if I'm miserable. But I go, and I joke, you know. I mean, I have a sense of humor about this stuff. The first really scary thing I did in Bosnia, I remember just, like, coming down Mount Igman. You know, there's fighter jets over there, and I was terrified. And, you know, this was in the 90s. And I just remember just kind of cracking jokes. And I might have had a cigarette, okay, and I don't smoke. But that's... and I think now, I mean, I can fly to Baghdad, and I can sleep through the landing. I mean, you get used to it, and you also are kind of in denial. And I also, I mean, one of the things I do, and I get, quite honestly, quite maternal about some of the other people we send over to Iraq who don't have the experience, and frankly, the experience isn't going to save my life in with a roadside bomb. But I feel better, and I feel better prepared, because I know how to get out of a Humvee. I know if I feel pretty confident with the soldiers I'm with. I know whether I've had a safety briefing or not. I hate to say this, but one time I asked a soldier how to use his weapon, because they'd given this unbelievable, this is the Marines again, actually. It was the Marines, and they give this whole brief about, you know, if so-and-so goes down, you take the gun, and if so-and-so goes down, you take the gun. And I find myself, just me and my cameraman in the back with one Marine. So I look at my cameraman and I said, if he goes down? So I said, would you mind just showing us at least how to get it off safety? Because I'd feel really stupid if we were attacked and I was standing here with all this stuff and just saying, just a minute. But I think, I mean, the fear part, and, you know, I mean, I have two kids, and I mean, it's, I think I would have had a harder time if my kids were really little. I mean, I think they understand it. I joke about my son, who's a 15-year-old, you know, sort of monosyllabic, wonderful kind of, you know, football player kind of kid. And he, for my birthday, gave me all these little nice lotions, because I am kind of girly. And he said, Mom, hope this brightens your day in Iraq. You know, if not, give it to my sister. Who cares? But, you know, I think we all cope, and I think that's his coping mechanism. And it was very hard on my family, all of us at ABC as well, when Bob and Doug were hurt, because we know them, and they're friends. And my son, in his coping mechanism, always used to joke with me, no matter what promotion I got at ABC, it was like, so you're not the anchor, huh? You know, I mean, how they bring you down. It's like, I don't want to be the anchor, Jake. It's fine, you know. And when Bob was hurt, Jake said to me that morning, and he was very upset, he said, Mom, I changed my mind. I don't want you to be an anchor. So that was his coping, like, because if you're not an anchor, you won't get hurt. Mm-hmm. And he talked about Peter Jennings, too. He said, because the anchors have had a terrible year at ABC. So I think we all cope in different ways. I joke about it. So do the soldiers and Marines, frankly. Mm-hmm. I mean, you get over there, and you sort of have a sense of humor with one another and build each other up, and, you know, mm-hmm. and you just hope you're okay. Thanks.
a comment and a question about casualties. It's sort of inverted from Vietnam, where more died than were wounded. We're now back to the World War I scenario, where veterans, the returning soldiers were gassed, or they're partially blown up, and they were put in sanitariums, sort of out in the country, and they were there for decades, and so everyone sort of forgot about them. Not only don't we remember that, but we don't want to do that anymore. But that's the only precedent we have, and that's World War I. The question I have is, you spent a lot of time talking to a lot of people and asking a lot of questions. Did they ask you questions? What kind of questions did the soldiers and the people that were there ask you when you showed up? Did they reverse that at all?
I think they're interested in how the country responds to them. And I think, I ask them and they ask me about what it's like back here. Do people really care? Here's the thing that's different about this war, too. These guys are back and forth all the time. I mean, there was a Marine who was just leaving, a Marine general, when I was there a couple of months ago, and I said, and we were in the middle of the political debate, I said, when you hear the political debate about people, does it bother you? He said, not at all. Not at all. We don't think about it. We don't have time to think about it. And 2 weeks later, when he arrived home, he called me up and he said, you know all that stuff I told you? Forget it. This really bothers me now that I'm here. And I think what happens is when they're here and they see it and they go back 7 months later or a year later or back and forth and back and forth, then they wonder about that. I don't think, they think anyone dislikes them. But I think they think I don't think they understand the debate to a degree that it's supportive of them. I mean, it's just hard for them to see the debate as supportive. And I can't speak for all of them. So that's kind of the questions they ask. I mean, I spend most of my time asking them questions, I guess. But, I've known some of them for so long. I mean, it's unbelievable to see the same soldiers over there, 4 years later. Who've been there. I mean, it's literally I took a young producer with me last time, and everywhere we went, it was like, hi mother. She goes, this is like traveling with David Beckham. It's like, said, I know. I kind of know a lot of people here. This is but you do. I mean, and I can tell what year they were deployed by what they call the enemy, because we still can't decide on what to call the enemy. There was a guy in one of the briefings last time, and I said, you were here in second year. Right? You were here in like 2004? And he said, yeah, how'd you know? I said, because you called them anti-Iraqi forces. That's way yesterday. We don't do that anymore, so.
But they feel as comfortable.
Yes. Oh, they feel totally comfortable. Yeah, the bottom line is they feel totally comfortable talking to me about that stuff. And there's guys I don't know, and they'll be hostile to the media. And there was one Marine, said, are you one of the good ones or one of the bad ones? I said, are you one of the good ones or one of the bad ones? I said, try to imagine if I ask you that question. Are you a Haditha Marine or are you, somewhere else? And that shut him up. So, okay.
I work in development cooperation, and one of the things we get wrong almost all the time is a real knowledge of the behavior, the motivation, the compulsions, all the things of the people in other cultures with whom we work. After many years, we still don't understand it. This is not a criticism, but this is a book by an American,
yep,
for an American audience, about Americans, and that's what it was intended to be. But I get the impression of the Iraqis who were involved in this incident as kind of faceless, unfathomable people who are doing bad things. And I must admit, I find the American media almost uniformly unhelpful in explaining the deeper motivations and the historical factors which are causing this kind of behavior, which is leading, as you put it, to a global insurgency. I mean, what kind of motivation can... I guess my question is, when you were writing this book, did you ever wonder about the people on the other side?
Oh yeah. And I'll tell you, you're exactly right. I wrote this book for Americans, about Americans in a battle where there were people doing bad things, without question. Do I wish I could have gone into Sadr City and found all those people in that battle? Absolutely. Can we do it safely? No. There was not a chance. And in fact, I reached out to try to do exactly that, and they couldn't do it. I think there are not enough things written about Iraqis. I think you're absolutely right. I think we don't understand other cultures. But we are in a horrible position covering this war. It is incredibly dangerous. I lost two Iraqi colleagues this week who were assassinated, who I worked with in Baghdad. And I cannot tell you how dangerous it is to go out there and try to report, particularly for television, because you can't hide, to talk to Iraqis. You're absolutely right. There's not enough written. I mean, I think there's some amazing stuff written by, Fuad Ajami or people who understand the region better than most people. But there's not enough written, without question. I mean, the interpreter in here, by the way, in this, I was in email contact with the interpreter in this book. There was an Iraqi interpreter pinned down with the platoon who ended up fighting with the Americans against the Iraqis. I have seen him over the years. He has tried desperately to get out of Iraq, and he just was approved to get out of there.
How many people are waiting to get out?
Oh, there are, thousands and thousands of people waiting to get out, Iraqis. In fact, the relatives of our cameraman and sandman emailed me. I read this email to my children last night saying, can you believe this? I mean, just that they're, the rest of the family of the men who were killed are now terrified and trying to get out and ask me to do what I could. And it's an impossible process. But, I mean, bad enough that your relative has just been assassinated, that now you think the rest of the family is going to be assassinated as well. It's pretty terrifying.
What is the solution to this problem? Because to be involved in a battle like this, which you fundamentally don't understand, is a huge problem.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't know the solution. I think you probably should understand it beforehand. Okay,
just
go ahead.
Just a quick question. In your experience in Iraq, did you see any evidence on the ground of troops being affected by a lack of equipment or training, or hear complaints?
I did hear complaints. I didn't hear complaints about body armor or Humvees, but the question I ask is, there are these vehicles now called MRAPs, and mine-resistant, armor-protective something, system. Actually, I think that's right. I think I got it. But they call them the Cougars, and they have just developed them, and they're shaped, the hull is shaped like that. So when a bomb goes off below them, instead of blowing up through the Humvee, it's dispersed. And not a single soldier or Marine has been injured in one of those vehicles. Now, the Army has just ordered 17,000 of them. It will take $1 bazillion. And it will also not be done very rapidly. I mean, I think back to World War II, when I think we were building a ship a day, and the idea that our soldiers and Marines have to wait for this stuff that would protect them is, I can't imagine doing that. But I've heard some complaints, but not, I haven't heard a lot. I mean, I've gotten in vehicles early in the war, and they don't use these anymore with the Marines, where, we're all talking about armored Humvees, and the damn things were wide open on top. I'm like, guys, what's with the convertible? I'm not going out in this. They're like, well, we're Marines, ma'am. We got to get out and fight. I'm like, okay, I think I'll go back to the Humvee. But they don't use those anymore either.
Thank you.
So one of the parts in your book that I most appreciated was this, when you went in and talked about the families and the specifics of the families and hearing horrific news. And I wondered, after your book came out, for many of these folks that you talk about a very personal, heart-wrenching time, did you hear back
Yes.
from them after they read about themselves? And I just was wondering if you'd share some of that.
I have heard back from numerous family members. I talked to them and sent the books, and there were several people I called and said, I just want to read you these parts. Now, the parts that are incredibly personal, they obviously told me about it at the time. There's one young woman whose husband was killed, and I mean, the scene with her getting the body back is just intensely personal. And she called, and I said, how are you doing, Leslie? And she said, I thought everything was right, and, thank you. And I said, well, you've done an amazing thing. And she said, no, I'm still going through it every day. Nothing's in the past. But the families have been really, really supportive, and so have the soldiers. They really have. So that makes me happy. I never heard from the Sheehans, actually, although I saw that Pat Sheehan, Casey's father, was interviewed,
and said he felt comfort because he was happy to know his son died a hero. I the Casey Sheehan portion of this book, I loved writing about Casey Sheehan because I felt like I didn't know him at all, and I felt like I could just grab a part of his life and know who he was in ways that you hadn't done before.
Did it very well.
Thank you.
It was really nice.
Thank you.
These horrors that you've made us feel and almost see, is this going to go on forever? Have you had any thoughts? Are you going to say anything about a possible exit plan?
I mean, I think we're at a very hard time right now because I don't know that we know what the mission is, whether it's a long war, whether we need results right away. I mean, you hear this stuff about the Baghdad clock and the Washington clock, and it's true. And I went, the last time I was there, I went with Admiral Fallon, who is the new commander of Central Command. And he was going around saying, I need results now, I need results now, I need results now. And you hear Dave Petraeus, who's the long war advocate, and I thought, this must be awfully confusing if you're over here trying to figure out what you're trying to do. And then Admiral Fallon was even quoted as saying he doesn't want it called a long war anymore. I can't give you my opinion about what I think should be done. I can just say this. I think if they want to succeed there, it's going to take a long time, and I don't think there's any guarantee of success. When I say a long time, it's because it is sectarian warfare. It is an insurgency. There's nothing conventional about it. And the Al-Qaeda, which does these spectacular, horrible attacks, and really did. I mean, you know, the president is right. They did have a plan to foment a sectarian war, and they did move it along quite stunningly. But they are a very small segment, but have very big bombs. The larger problem in terms of making this go away, if it can ever be made to go away, is a long war. So,
but these fine subtleties don't answer the man who lost his eyes.
I know. And I mean, I think it's, no, they don't. None of those subtleties answer that. You're right. Yes.
You mentioned the Semper Fi Fund. I wonder if there are any other particular organizations or things you suggest that those of us here can do to help the troops and the veterans.
I think one of the Semper Fi Fund, it's called Wounded Marine Semper Fi Fund. It's on the web. And it honestly, it's just one of the, and I think we're all very careful about where we give our money and what they do with it. And I just found that the idea of no overhead. I know right now they are giving out more money than they're taking in, because I think that's another thing we all just sort of forget about it. That and the Bob Woodruff Family Fund for the Traumatic Brain Injured is another one, which Bob and Lee are just starting this up. I am on the board of that fund, and that is for the brain injured. But those two are terrific and will give long-term help to the wounded. That it. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings like this one, please go to npr.org/booktour.